The whole idea of dignifying a dish. Dignifying a dish. Tell me about
Okay.
your mom again.
So everything you just said about the restaurant in your area, Chez Talal, and the falafel we had, and the way that they heated up the falafel and prepared the sandwich.
Had its dedicated wok. That was the thing. It had
Okay.
its dedicated it was a spot like only falafel, only a falafel ball would be. Do you call it a falafel ball? What would you, what, or do you just call it just, it's just falafel?
I just call it falafel, but I guess if we're being, if we're going to talk about the piece of food that you're going to ingest, I guess you could call it a ball.
What would you say to your mom? If she was making in the kitchen, would you say, give me three of those? Or would you
Yeah, can I have
even
three
add?
falafels?
So
Or,
that's what you,
yeah.
that's what I want to know. Like, what's the
Okay.
unit?
That's
So
what
that's
I
why
would
I don't want,
think.
dude, I don't want to call it a falafel ball. And then, all of our Lebanese listeners are like, who is this? This white guy's just mashing it up.
Right.
Like, that's not right. So you would just call it falafel.
Yeah, just falafel.
Beautiful.
So, okay, everything you just said about Chez Talal and their dedicated wok with the oil in it just for the falafel remind and my favorite part was when you said that all of this is slightly dangerous, like the way you pick it up, what you use to pick, it's all dangerous because even as a child watching my mom make falafel, look, everything about my mom's house is dangerous. And I know that because my wife will bring it to my attention. So my mom's got these pots and pans that are like about 1,000 years old. I guarantee that the chemicals coming off of them or whatever is just not good for anybody. But
The
yeah, oh yeah.
paint.
Okay, anyway, so my mom's got this one pot. It's green on the outside, or at least it was. And the inside, it's really funny because it's a hard, strong pot, but the inside, the metal looks soft. I guess it's been just used and worn so much that it doesn't look like hard steel. But anyway, so my mom would put, about this much oil in it. I'm guessing that's about I don't know, 50, no, maybe 10 centimeters, 15 centimeters of oil. And she'd put it on and heat it up to, and there's no oil thermometer or anything. There's nothing to gauge the heat of the oil. Nothing. Like here, like if I wanted to deep fry French fries in my kitchen, first of all, I'm guarantee you my wife would be upset if I just had a pot of oil sitting on the burner. Like, and then no thermometer to gauge the temperature. Like, my wife would die.
Well,
But
you're
anyway.
going on Amazon. You're going on Amazon and you're going to buy yourself a fryer just so it could be plugged in. Because it all,
But I don't want to. I want to do it like my mom did it.
of course not. But that's the reasonably hand-drawn facsimile. Sits on the countertop. You know it's going to output French fries at the end or whatever it is you're going to fry. You know it's
Yeah.
going to output your falafel. But the fact of it is, when it's point and click, it's a step away from what you're actually making. Like, it's you're making something, but are you
But
really
you're
making something?
right. So anyway, so every time I go home and the danger, right? I'm getting lost here because I'm so focused in on the food because I can taste. My mouth is watering from the falafel we had in Newmarket. But anyway,
Mentioning it as Chez Talal. Seriously,
Chez
you're up.
Talal.
If any of our many listeners, no, why not? Right? We're not sponsored here, but this will be a footnote in yours and my friendship forever. Right? The fact that we got pre-COVID. This is where we do memory lane. Remember back in the day, memory lane. We could
Well, it
say
wasn't
we.
pre-COVID.
True. True. It was. It
Start
was.
of COVID. I don't
Yeah.
know. Because we were
Yeah.
both in separate cars. We
We
kept
were.
2 meters apart the whole time.
It was the first summer. It was last
Okay.
summer, right? The
It was the
first.
first COVID
But being able to still go there, eat outside,
Yes.
and it's forever going to be like just anyone coming up this way, hit me up. hit me up, message me on Twitter. You want, I'll go for a sandwich. They're still selling sandwiches now. But 3 weeks ago, took the family there and we got the sandwiches. And it's funny because that day I wasn't prepared for the turn up. I wasn't ready for the turn up. I was not ready for it. It was hitting my mouth like a sledgehammer.
Oh.
And I thought to myself, do I pull it out? Do I take it? And anyone that's, you know, you get your pickled vegetable, it's watering up. My mouth's watering right now. But everything else was rock solid. The pepper sauce, the tahini, the garlic sauce. Oh.
Can we go back to my mom's kitchen?
I so want to. Take me back.
So when I was a kid, my mom would have this pot, and that's where she fried everything that she needed to fry. There was mm-hmm. no fryer, there's no temp gauge, nothing. It was like, put it on. And that oil, dude, that oil would sit in that pot. I think it's probably still sitting there with the same oil. Like that, there's none of this. Okay, we're done now. We got to get rid of the oil. It was like, no, that pot stays there until the next time we make falafel. And, or eventually, what my mom would do, would she take that oil and pour it into like a mason jar and be like, that's the falafel oil. So the next time we're making falafel, you're not using new oil, you're using that oil because you can use it a bunch of times before you think about tossing it. But anyway, I remember watching my mom just like get all the stuff and just put it together. And she had this tool that she'd use to make the falafel balls. Yep. One of the few culinary tools that were in my mom's kitchen. And she would literally just take a spoon, roll it up, throw it onto this thing, do something, pop it off. And there you had the nice, perfect, like sometimes it looked like a football. Sometimes it was more squished like a basketball that was kind of squished down a little bit. And she'd fry them up. And when I was a kid, I hated them. I learned something later on in my life about your taste buds changing as you get older. Your taste buds develop and the different parts of your tongue develop with what they're supposed to taste. Mm-hmm. And when I was a kid, I was just like, this is disgusting. And then I remember I don't remember what age it was, probably like late teens, like university. I think I remember my friends saying, we're going to go get shawarma and falafel. And I was like, falafel? You guys are a bunch of doofuses. So I got a shawarma. But then I remember going to my mom's house. Well, I lived there. But I said, hey, mom, can you make some falafel sometime? She's like, yeah, sure. So she made some.
You know you made her heart swell when you said that.
Yeah, yeah. She was.
Yeah, even if it's not showing. It was the same thing with like my grandmother when I would ask her to make cabbage rolls. Because it was the same for me. I was like, oh, these are like, I could not take, I just was not there. But I can remember when I finally asked, I asked her directly to make one. Of course, she was a little like, kind of stared me down a little bit for a second. She's like, okay, sit down. I'm like, okay, yay.
Yeah, so I'm like, mom, can you make some falafel? So she made some. And I remember eating it, and my mom didn't just make like if my mom made falafel, there were tomatoes from here to like down the street, like everything. Mm-hmm. Like she made enough food for an army, and I just wanted a couple of sandwiches, you know? Mm-hmm. And I remember eating it thinking, holy shit, my mom made this. This is like, you know, epic. So then in my early days with Sarah, when we'd go visit my mom, she would make falafel because she knew Sarah liked them. And it was just the bomb. Like falafel night, like the night that we would eat dinner with my mom, it was just like whatever she made, it was enough to feed an army. Like my wife raves about my mom's rice. She's never been able to have Middle Eastern rice that tastes like my mother's. Mm-hmm. So when we go to my mom's house and my boys who they love some of the ethnic food that my mom makes. So when we go before all this COVID stuff, the night that we eat dinner with my mom, because usually we would go out and meet up with my friends or whatever and have some fun in Ottawa. The night that we'd eat with my mom, basically I'd say to my kids, like, we shouldn't really eat lunch because Teta's going to make so much food. It's going to be unbelievably ridiculous.
What did you just say? What's the name?
Teta.
One more time for me.
Teta.
How do you spell that?
T-E-T-A.
Oh, that's pretty straightforward. Yeah.
Teta. Yeah. That's what they call her. That's grandma in Lebanese, or that's what they call her, Teta. And she would, it's unbelievable. You should see them inhale the food. And now as they're getting older, like my 14-year-old would probably just, we wouldn't have to worry about any leftovers. He'd just eat them all, you know? And my youngest, who's 11, who's going to be 12, the next time we go see my mom, God willing, everything's good and she's still able to cook and stuff. If she does cook for us, it's going to get devoured. The rice, mm-hmm. even to this, like this, it's the marker, right? It's the benchmark. When I ate that falafel of Shay Talal, I don't know if you remember, but I think I told you it tastes like my mother's. So right away I was like, I'm in. These people know what they're doing. They're making this in the back. They're not buying frozen falafels from anywhere. And if they are, then it must be an old lady down the street who's literally making them up and someone's freezing them, because it's not like a, you know, big brand store or anything like that. This was the real deal stuff that I was tasting, and the sauces were unbelievable. So anyway, that pot, that dangerous pot in the kitchen, was there all my life, you know, heating up that oil. Nobody knew how hot it was. And my mom to this day still has these little towel type things that she uses to pick everything up with. It's just, it makes me sad because I don't know how to make that stuff. And I know a couple of times my wife would sit and watch my mom, and then when we come home, my wife would try to replicate what my mom did. And it just, my wife has never been satisfied. And yeah. Can you write this down? And my mom's like, there's nothing to write down. Like,
just watch. Yeah. Just watch. Just
grab some of this and grab some of that. So, I mean, as I talk to you today, I'm grateful that my kids have had a chance to spend time with their teta, eat her food, watch her cook. My mom's kind of ornering the kitchen. She doesn't want help. I mean, sometimes she'll ask for, hey, can you go do this for me or whatever? But she doesn't want help. She doesn't want anybody watching. She amuses us sometimes and lets us. But now that she's much older now, right? Like when Sarah and I were going there, it was 20-odd years ago. So my mom gotten a lot older, and making falafels, it's hard. So she finds other ways. She cuts corners. Like a few years ago when we were in Ottawa, it's always a negotiation. I'm like, okay, mom, we're here for 4 days. What night are we hanging with you? And it's gotten to the point where it's like, okay, because my mom was working a lot, and she still would be if it wasn't for COVID. But I told my mom, I'm like, don't take a night off work for me. Like, if you need to work, work. Like, just can we all be straight? Like, let's not play these games anymore, because there's lots of games. Let's not play these games. Like, what night are you available? You tell me, and then I will work around it. I won't go see my best buddy. We won't go out for dinner with the kids. Like, we'll stay home. So my mom's like, okay, Thursday night. I'm not going to work Thursday night. Okay. So then, you know, Thursday, she'll say, what are you doing today? And in Ottawa, my mom doesn't have a lot of stuff for the kids to do at her house, and we never invested in it. I don't know why we should have. It would have been smart to invest in a bunch of stuff for when we visited, but we would always take the kids to a museum or something, because it was boring at Teta's house. There was nothing for them to do. So she's like, what are you doing today? I'm like, well, what do you need, mom? And she's like, okay, can you go to the Lebanese butcher down the street and get the meat? I'm like, tell me more, mom. She's like, I'm too old and I've got too much going on. I don't have time to buy the meat, the beef, and then to season it and da-da-da-da-da. They just do it for me. I just call them and tell them I need this type of meat seasoned this way. And she goes, I trust them. They've done it before and they do a good job. I'm like, okay. Now, this is a whole experience in and of itself. So I'm like, where's this place? So she tells me. So I drive to this place, and we go, the whole family goes into the store.
Of course.
Yeah, the whole family goes in the store, and the minute you walk in, it smells like my childhood, like all the spices and everything, right? This Middle Eastern store that's packed. There's so much friggin' food in there. I don't even know who buys this stuff, but there's all kinds of canned goods, and there's a butcher there or whatever. And I walk in, and automatically they start talking to me in Arabic. And I'm like, good morning, how are you? You know, like I'm like, I put my hands up like, yeah, okay, lock me up. I can't speak it anymore. I'm not even going to try to pretend that I can speak to you in my mother tongue. So
you respond in English?
I always do right away to disarm everybody, because the longer you go, the worse it's going to be when they find out that you're not going to respond to them in their language. This is just a feeling I have. So you know, that you walk in, they're like, hey, how's it going or whatever. I'm like, hey, I'm good. Good morning. How are you? Like, I unleash the English so that they're like, oh, this guy is he doesn't know what he's doing. So I'm like, my mom sent me, this is her name. I'm here to pick up some meat for my mom. And my kids are fascinated there, because these Middle Eastern stores always look the same. They're packed to the gills with all kinds of product. The smell hits you the minute you walk in. It's unbelievable. There's something about them. So I tell the guy, yeah, I'm here for my mom's meat. He's like, okay. So he goes into the back, comes out with these bags of seasoned. There's parsley in there. It's like the bags are leaking with some kind of condensation. Like, it's unbelievable. So I pay for it. He gives it to me. We leave. We go home. Like, yeah, I don't think the guy at the place was very interested in talking to me. She's like, yeah, they're pretty hardcore there, you know. White, and my mom will say this, she's like, if white people walk in, they'll probably ignore them until the white person shows that they're worthy of being in there. Like, it's very, there's this way about it. I don't agree with it. I think it's wrong, but there is something there, you know. Anyway, long story short, my mom won't make the meat anymore because it's too much work, but she'll certainly get it done down the street. And then she uses these pans that are older than I am. Again, the metal. I think when Sarah sees it, she's like, shit, do we have to eat off that? Like, is your mom cooking off that? And I'm like, hun, just let it go. Like, I'm still alive. There's nothing wrong with me. So we must be okay. Like, that type of thing. So anyway, my mom makes these huge pans of this meat with potatoes and tomato sauce. And then the rice cluff, she makes enough rice to feed my hockey team when I was 15. There's no reason to make that much rice, but she did that way.
It's the funny, but I mean, what I've noticed in some foods, cultures, that it's, I mean, when we talk about the food groups, different cultures look at the food groups different ways, very different, especially when they're cooking, right? And there are, you know, there's the cultures where there has to be more flatbread because that's what you're using as cutlery. And then there's the cultures there's the cultures that have the rice because, oh, gotta stop drooling. There's the cultures that, you know, depend on rice because many of their dishes, homestyle dishes, are sort of sauce or stew based. Mm-hmm. So you need something. And then in that case, it might actually be there's not a flatbread that's used. You actually use your hands to eat. So there has to be something. There has to be sometimes that vehicle to catch all the goodness.
Right.
So by ratio, I get it. Probably her ratio was still off. It was too much rice. But for some, that's the starting point, and all the dishes come after that, right? So the rice goes with this, the rice goes with that, the rice goes with the chicken, the rice goes with the meat. Like, it goes, it's going to be parsed out in all the right spaces.
100%. But let me tell you the shift. So at the beginning... the beginning, I'm like, mom, the kids are young. We're not going to eat this tomorrow because we're going out for dinner with so-and-so, or the kids want to go to Lone Star for lunch. Like I told you, when we go to Ottawa and the kids were a little bit younger, it was about, okay, we're here to visit you guys, but we need to keep them busy. So it's like, it's a trip to Ottawa to see family, but it's more than that. It's, I'm going to see my best friend. We're going to eat at different restaurants that only exist in Ottawa that they really like. Stuff like that, right? We're going to go to the museums or whatever in Ottawa. If it's winter, you know, we're going to go to the canal. Like, we're going to do stuff. So I would say to my mom early on, mom, you made so much food. Like, nobody's going to eat it tomorrow. She's like, don't worry. Your brother will eat it. Your sister will come over and eat it. I'll eat it. I'm like, that's fine. But we're not eating it tomorrow for lunch because the kids want to go here. We're going to do this. So she's like, okay. So here's the switch. When we switched over and both the boys started eating like animals, you know, the next day they'd be like, hey, dad, yeah, can we, is there any food left from last night? I'm like, oh, yeah. can we have some for breakfast? I'm like, yup. And then I'm in the kitchen with everything out on the table, and I'm heating up all this food for them, and they're just devouring it, which makes my mom very happy, as you can imagine, right?
Yep, yep.
That, they're eating up all this stuff that she made. So makes me kind of sad that one day she's not going to be with us, and that's not going to happen anymore. But until then, we're going to keep enjoying. We're going to keep enjoying this. And like I said, when we'll be in the car driving to Ottawa, and the kids will say, "Do you think Teta will make this for us?" I'm like, "You just drop the word, and she'll be in the kitchen cooking." If I say it, she might not, but if you guys say it, she might. So hit her up when we get there early so that she knows what she's cooking for us. But, yeah, it's like those places are just like, makes me sad thinking about it, but I've tried to watch and emulate, and I don't know. I can't. I mean, I could, but I just don't. And then my mom does have a cookbook, but it's written in Arabic and Armenian. So I can't even, and this book is old, dude. Like, I don't even know how it's still in one piece. Like, no pages are attached to the spine of the book. There's a spine, there's a cover, a front
cover. And then an elastic.
Actually, she doesn't even use the elastic, and then all the papers are just inside. You know what? Man, I wish this friggin' COVID thing would end. When I get back to my mom's house, I'll take a picture of it. I'll do my best to remember to take a picture of it. And it's just written in two other languages, and I have no clue what it says. And I don't even think my mom follows it anymore. Like, she just, when she makes something, she just makes it. And she's got it. She's got it going on. And I can taste it. So when we go to, okay, you know how we talk about being racist and anti-racist? Mm-hmm. I think I've told you, I think I said it on Twitter too, I tend to be racist of my own people. Like when my wife says, "Can we have Middle Eastern food for dinner?" Well, not can we, but like, let's order out Middle Eastern food. I'm like, I want nothing to do with it. Hmm. She's like, why? I'm like, the service is always, they always get the order wrong. The service is never what it's supposed to be. And she's like, why do you say that? I'm like, because it happens almost every time we go to one of these restaurants. She's like, you know what you're saying, right? I'm like, I know. It's wrong. I shouldn't say it, but I've experienced it so many times. It's wrong, but I've experienced it so many times that my brain says you're right. This is really weird to talk about, but
it is. You hit me hard with something that you said there. Like, I have huge, huge regrets that I never learned to cook for my grandmother. Huge regrets. And I've talked to my mom a little bit about putting together a recipe book from some of the stuff that she knows how to do. Mm-hmm. And we haven't made it there yet. And my fear is that we never do. That's a real fear that I have, that we never, ever I never get to a space where I can learn from that, despite my asking for it. Because there is something funny. This kind of has happened several times with my mom. If I were to watch cooking, like there's some, okay, actually I'll go in a different room. So on the on-ramp, talk about how fortunate I was. We were talking about how, like, I tend to not want to pay for Italian food. Like, that's my chef training. It's difficult for a lot of the things that you said. I've completely assimilated the culture. So in my head, my heart, I know Italian cuisine at a deeper level than a Polish Irish individual probably should. And that just comes from my training. Right. So, the whole idea of, even when I was learning my craft, even when I was in my apprenticeship, I was never trusted. I was never trusted because I wasn't family. The irony there is the reason that I became an Italian chef was I was actually, so I got a job at this restaurant that I ultimately did my apprenticeship at. I got it through a reference from another job. So it was a good kind of handshake. I was working at a roadhouse in Guelph, really good one, called the Portly Penguin. Cool restaurant. I don't think it's there anymore, but it was a really cool restaurant. Lots of stories that come out of that, but that'll be another Decoded episode. So I went traveling across Canada. I think I've told you I went for a year and I was kind of gone across Canada. Have I told you about that? I was a snowboard instructor for a while. Okay. So I came back from that trip and I needed to work. So I didn't want to go back to Poorly Penguin. I was kind of done with that. I probably could have. I left on great terms. It was just I wanted something new. So I applied to a different restaurant, and it's called Manhattan Pizza. Can't even believe I'm remembering this. So Manhattan Pizza was kind of it was pizza and a jazz bar. And I thought that'd be cool. That'd be kind of a cool place. And I knew the owners because they used to come into the Roadhouse all the time. So they'd close up their restaurant, which was up the street. They'd come down to Portly, have a few beers. They'd come for karaoke night, that kind of stuff. So I went there to apply and they say, sorry, we don't have any jobs, but we do know of another restaurant in town that's looking for servers. I'm like, great. So I ended up on the opposite end of the town. And the restaurant was called La Fontana, and it had been in the family forever. So the fountain, amazing, out in like it was like the industrial area of Guelph. Like there's all it was like Linamar and all these sort of mechanical manufacturing spaces. And you had La Fontana restaurant just plunked right down in there. And from the outside, you'd think it was a factory too. You go inside, it was a really nice restaurant. So anyways, it was a New Year's Eve. I'm looking to make big bucks for serving. And their chef didn't show up, just didn't bother to show up that evening. So they said to me, they said, look, we'll compensate you for your lost wages for the tips. Would you like to come in the kitchen and help? So they had known that I'd been working in restaurants for a long, long time. So I had more experience in kitchen. I was a good salesperson there as well. I'm like, sure. And I never looked back. Despite the fact I jumped in and helped them when they were in need, because it was a New Year's Eve and we were booked solid, double, like it was solid. Despite the fact that they openly said, would you like to do the apprenticeship? I still wasn't trusted. I didn't really ask a lot of questions because as soon as I did, so I mentioned before Maria. Maria was my mentor. Johnny was the chef I was signed up with. He was the owner. He had a chef's paper. So my apprenticeship was connected to him. My learning was primarily connected to Maria. Maria would talk everything through. She would tell me to watch. She would tell me, you know, sort of like tap me on the hand if I wasn't sort of chopping something the right way. I'm like, okay, sorry. And then, but what was funny was, so she would intensively be demonstrating something and then she'd look at me like, okay, you understand? We're good. We can move on. I'm like, yeah, I'd ask a question and she would do this. I was like, what? Like there was no trust. As soon as I asked a question, then the trust was broken. It was the most, I got used to it, but it was funny. I learned to listen better. I had to take it in as it was being shown to me. So flash forward to I did have conversations with my grandmother about stuff. Exact same look. Ironically, my grandmother's name is also Maria. And she would give me the exact same, I don't trust you. I think it was more her look though was, it was like I was taking away the opportunity for her to demonstrate love. If I asked her, oh, what's in this? Just eat it. Yeah, but what's in it? Just eat it. What's in it? Chiho, which is like saying be quiet or like shut up, depending on how you're, right? Just eat. That's my really rough Polish, by the way. And my grandmother in Polish is babcia. Babcia. So B-A-B-C-I-A, babcia. But I would get the same look. Mistrust. Mistrust. If I ask too many questions, just eat. So through that, I learned a really deep respect for the elder in the kitchen, which probably my grandmother Maria hardwired into me. So when I worked with Italian Maria, she was tripping on all the grandmother rules. Like I was just like, okay, sorry. And she was like 5'1". She might've been 75 pounds, but she would hit. So I knew that, you know, when I'd done wrong. So I love this. When you talked about not getting the recipes or not being able to get the recipes or sort of thinking to yourself that there's like a limited amount of time before you won't be able to get the recipes. That hits me hard. Like I think I hear you. because those are real. That's memory. That's family. It's, you know, the feel goods. It's a story. Like, there's so much to it. It's so layered. Now, my mom knows some of the recipes, and I've tried to ask her. I was like, can we get these things down, or can you show me? And I get the sense she just doesn't want to. Bless her heart, but I get the sense she just doesn't necessarily. Actually, you know what? I don't know exactly what it is. And she's probably going to listen to this episode, and she's going to come back. But I have asked a couple times. And I think just we haven't gotten around to it. But I also get the sense, like, I think there's something about the dignity of feeding your children, or the dignity of feeding your family, or the dignity of feeding your friends, that when they start to ask for those same recipes, it's like they're taking away the opportunity for you to love them. And for some cooks, I think that strikes very deeply in their hearts. I think for some cooks, that's a very deep little bit of feels that as they're sort of shuffling you out of the kitchen, get out, go, 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 go. And it sounds like they're about to backhand you. They're ramping up their love. They're ramping up. They're getting so full of that emotional state of I get to take care of someone that, you know, sometimes it can be frightening because you know they're going to hit you, take a little swat at you. But I think a big part of it is the whole opportunity to demonstrate love and care. I would say me as a cook in my own house, that's a big part of what it is. It is. It is a way that I can, it's a physical manifestation. If I don't have the words, if I can't always find the words, me being able to do a great roast chicken is a physical manifestation of how deeply I care for my family. So it's complex.
Okay, so all this talk has me, I'm making a connection to work.
Okay.
And I'm my connection brings me to the student, the Syrian student that I taught several years ago that made such an impact on me. Mm-hmm. As a person and as an educator, I guess my final chapter of my teaching career, I'll never forget the first time he brought in, his lunch was Syrian food, Middle Eastern food. And I could smell it and I knew what it was right away.
Triggered,
but in a couple of different ways. One way was it reminded me of my childhood. The other way was it reminded me of how I was treated poorly and negatively at school when I had food like that. So I was concerned for him. We've talked about that before and it all went well, but I remember talking to him about the food and saying, like, who made this? How'd they make it? Did you buy it somewhere? Like, It was nice to connect, and I have that at my current school big time because many students in my school are from other countries, and so there's always different types of food at lunch. And it's funny because when I would talk to my students about their food and ask questions, they look at me funny. I get the sense that they're like, why are you interested in this? Why are you asking questions? I'm like, hey, I'm just like you. I grew up bringing these different types of food to school. Nobody wanted to talk to me about my food. People made fun of me for my food. I don't want that culture in my classroom. In my classroom, I want you to tell me what it tastes like, how you eat it, what it's called. And to this day, you know, the kids laugh at me because, you know, somebody will open their lunch and I'll say, is that such and such? They're like, no, that's not that. This is this. And then they laugh at me like, this old man, we keep telling him what the names of the foods are and he keeps messing it up. And I'm like, no, don't, you know, I'm glad that they can enjoy that. For me, it's share with us. How do you eat this? Like, you know, one day I said to one student, I said, where's your spoon? Because I eat this with my hands. And I was like, oh, shoot. Like, It was a very important moment. I said, oh, awesome. Okay, go wash your hands with soap and water. He goes, you just sanitized my hands. I said, you don't want to eat with your hands after having put sanitizer on it. You don't want to do that. Go wash them with soap and water so they're legit clean. Mm-hmm. And then come back and eat with your hands. And it was funny because he wasn't sure which way I was going to go. I think he thought that I was going to hammer him for eating with his hands. I'm like, no, if that's how you eat your food at home, if that's how you've been taught to eat this meal, you're not going to get resistance from me. You're going to get acceptance. You're going to get assistance. So I don't want you eating with your hands, with the sanitizer on your hands. Go wash the sanitizer off. Because I know before I eat my lunch, when I used to work in the school building, when I was washing my hands with soap and water, I could feel the sanitizer coming off, that layer of whatever that stuff is, right?
It's like the weird moisturizer.
Yeah. So it's like, no, I want my hands soap and water fresh when I pick up my sandwich or whatever. And it was rare for me to touch anything with my bare hands, but there was something about getting that sanitizer off my hands and using soap, right?
Yep.
So, I'll never forget that. He looked at me like, oh man, am I going to get ham? I'm like, no, dude, if you start tossing the food or whatever, we're going to have a problem. But if this is how you eat at home, I'm not going to get in your way, but I do want you to make sure you're safe and clean. Like for sure. I so love COVID's killing me. Because my culture, everything about my culture is let's gather and eat, right? Like, we need to talk about something. Okay, come over. Let's do it over food. I'll never forget when my father passed away and we had people over after the funeral service and stuff. There was food like everywhere. And it was hard. It was hard to be in the moment of enjoying people's company because my head wasn't really there, but I remember close friends of mine throughout the years saying to me, just for a moment, forgetting that we were together because somebody had passed, and saying like, Roland, I know you've been eating this food since you were a kid, but you got to come over here and try this stuff. I don't know who made this, but it's delicious. And I'm like, don't say that out loud. My mom didn't make it and she'll take off. So it was, but I mean, even in those hard times, it's like people are, they're sharing food to connect. And I so wish we could be doing that at school. I know an intermediate teacher I worked with many years ago, Kelly Grant is her name. She's a great teacher, been teaching intermediate and junior forever. Actually, we started like the same year. We were in my first year of teaching here in Waterloo with the Catholic Board. She was one of my teaching partners, and my buddy Ted was the other teaching partner, and the three of us were brand new teachers. Not one shred of experience. I think Kelly had done like an LTO the year before for half a year or something. And then she got a full-time permanent job. So the three of us were together and we didn't know what we were doing. But Kelly would do these things with her class where, and I'm sure lots of teachers do this, she would have like a lunch day where everybody would bring in food from like their house that was important to them. Or even if it wasn't food from their house, it was a potluck lunch. And she would always invite the teachers to come and join in and participate and enjoy the lunch. And I'll never forget like the laughter and the conversation. And it just reminded me of being at home. There's this, all this food and people are coming in and out. Teachers, you know, run in. They're like, thanks for inviting me. Try a couple of things. I got to go for duty. This was delicious. And it wasn't like being at work. It was like being in somebody's house, taking it easy, enjoying. And what was happening during that time is we were building rapport and relationship.
Community.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, other teachers did it here and there, but nobody ever did it like Kelly did it. So I remember those were good times, and things have changed around like what kids can bring in to eat and what we can ask them to bring in and stuff. It's gotten a lot tighter and healthier, which is not a bad thing, but I think there needs to be room and space to recognize culturally that sometimes that is important, especially with like at my school. My wife and I were talking about my school the other day, and we were talking about some of the logistical ways of operating in a school. And yep. She would say something, I'm like, oh, that doesn't work at John's. She's like, what do you mean? I'm like, it doesn't work like that. She's like, yeah, but that's what the policy says. I'm like, yeah, I appreciate what the policy says. And I said, I appreciate how you're operating at your school, but at my school, it doesn't work. And she's like, well, how do you navigate that? And I'm like, well, you have to, I said, put yourself in my shoes for a couple of minutes and think about the learners in front of me and the challenges that come with them. If I follow policy, I'm going to lose half my kids. I'm not saying for the many listeners out there, I'm not saying that we are ignoring policy. I'm just saying you look at the policy, you look at your situation, and then you make a professional judgment on what needs to happen in order to move forward so that student achievement's occurring. Everybody's mm-hmm. still okay, and we're not breaking 8,000 rules. But that's the other thing too. When you look at racism and anti-racism, you need to look at your policies and how were your policies created? Because if they weren't, and I'm not saying the policies are racist. What I'm saying is that they're not always racist, but they don't always work either. They don't always take into account these strange situations or a school full of the same type of clientele, and just doesn't work the same way at this school. So it's funny because my wife will say something and I'll say, well, at John's, it doesn't kind of work like that. And she'll be like, well, well, and I'll say, well, well, the teachers have to do what they have to do to move forward. Administration is friendly to our cause and they want everybody to move forward. So sometimes when you operate in a way where you're looking at a kid's best interest and a family's best interest and a school community's best interest, the book isn't going to necessarily help you do that. Mm. You don't throw it out. You learn to become fluent with it. You understand how it works so you can navigate it in a professional manner. So it was just interesting because it was a cool conversation because for once in a long time, my wife did say to me, yeah, that's got to be hard to navigate those waters. And I said, it is. And it is kind of making me nervous that when I move on, will I be flexible enough to switch back to like how the book goes? Or I don't know what's going to happen. What I'd like to think is that I'm learning how to be really mentally flexible and understand what the book says, but also understand how to lead in a school that is different and that the book doesn't really apply to in some ways.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know we started with food, but well, here, Sherry is listening and she made a comment and she said that she loves how you meet them where they're at. And when she says how you meet them, I think of how we meet them, right? Because Sherry once was my vice principal. And so she was helping to run the school that I work at. And not only were the teachers meeting them where they were at, but I believe that the administration was meeting us where we were at and then helping us move the kids forward. So it's like, it truly was nice to have everybody working together to move everybody in the proper direction. But I like that I touched upon the racist and anti-racist policies, because if you're not creating policy that's anti-racist, then you could be getting yourself into a lot of trouble or situations that alienate people and make them feel like they don't belong. And I can tell you that my school board right now is doing a lot of really cool things around equity, diversity, and inclusion. And one of the committees that they have connected to the head equity steering committee is like a working group with HR to look at hiring practices and stuff. And so like the fact that they're having these conversations is positive to me in that we're most likely moving in an anti-racist way, but being very aware of it, you know, rather than just create policy, we're looking at policy, or I think they are. I'm not on the team, but I think they're looking at their practice and their process, and then seeing, well, how does this interfere with people actually like working here, and then switching things up. So I wanted to make that connection to school, because as we were talking about food, family, community, I feel like we're losing some of that at school because of the way school has become. And COVID is doing its best to kill those things. It's doing its best. It's not going to work, though, because we're beating COVID. And I think once it's gone and it's under control and we can stop wearing masks and start, like, I can start teaching effectively again, or at least effectively by the old standard of what was effective, because there's lots of high yield strategies at work. I'm looking forward to that day. If it's okay with you, can I shift gears for a minute? Since we're on this, we're talking about family and food. I wanted to share something, a book I'm reading, and how it's killing me. And I can make the connection to why I prefer not to read. Can I do that?
Yeah, absolutely, man.
Okay, so I'm reading From the Ashes by Jesse Thistle. And the book is a really good book, and it's Jesse's memoir about growing up as a Cree indigenous person, and his lived experience with addiction and homelessness, and how he's come out of all that and like he's become really successful now, and
he's come through it, just kind of pushing the language because That's what I've sort of learned. You push back too, but I think it's, yeah, the whole idea of coming out of it.
It's part of his, it's his lived experience. He's talking about who he is, where he's come from, and where he is now.
And
I've seen some interviews on YouTube and stuff, and he talks about, in those brief interviews, he talks about how, like, this is just all part of his life. So, I mean, had it not happened, he may not be where he is today, and he really likes where he is today. So, dude, it's killing me because I'm reading this book, and he's in the first half, in the first third of the book, I guess, and then leading into the half of the book, he's talking about his dad. So, I don't want to tell his story. It's not mine to tell, but he's basically saying that he's with his grandparents. They're raising him and his brothers, and he's constantly in search of his dad. When the phone rings and they pick it up, but the person on the other end doesn't say anything, he's like, "Is that my dad?" And dude, oh, it took me back to when my father passed away. And I think for, well, many years, I think the last time I had this type of dream was maybe 2 or 3 years ago, where I dream that my father's not really dead. He's just hiding somewhere and living another life. And he wants nothing to do with us anymore. And as I'm reading Jesse's book, and he's talking about the phone rings, where's my dad? The people, they don't know where he is. They think he might be here. They think he might be there. And I don't know how this plays out in the end, because I've not read I'm halfway through. Oh, it's been killing me. And it made me think a couple of times, this is why I don't do this. Because when you read somebody else's story, you feel things. You feel compassion. You make connections. I hope that you become more empathetic as a human. And as these things are happening to me, I'm getting these feels that I'm just not interested in feeling, especially at, like, you know, 10:30 p.m. when it's dark out, and there's nobody to talk to. And it's like, oh man, this is what I'm reading, and I got to go to bed with this now. So I just wanted to share that it's unbelievable how we can learn. We have the tools to connect with people and learn. In the olden days, before YouTube and stuff and the internet, you know, somebody would give you this book and say, this is a life-changing book, read it. And that's it. I mean, you might be able to write a letter to the publisher trying to get it to the author or whatever, but there's no guarantee. I'm reading this book and I'm like watching, it's awesome, all the peripheral items I have, like the YouTube videos and the articles about Jesse and his thoughts about his book and his experience. It's like, it's wonderful to round out the experience. So I'm glad that I'm reading it, but feeling this conversation reminds me of that, of feeling mm-hmm. my dad's presence and I guess trying to let go of the fact that he's not here. And it's okay that he's not here. He's not hiding. He's not around and doesn't want anything to do with me.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think about, you sort of said, you said something to the effect of how it, I don't think you said the word improves, but you were talking about how your empathy engine kind of, it's like the scene from The Grinch where the animated, it said, and in that moment, what was it? His heart grew 5 times bigger, right? I think that can be really, it's one thing to have your empathy engine triggered. I think there's something else that can be happening too, is just the empathy engine turning on. And for some people, you know, it can't happen with reading. It can happen. There's a lot of different experiences that can just turn on that empathy engine. I don't know if it feels the exact same way, but I think people might be in different stages of that. And sort of once it is kind of kicked in, you know, the hope is that you're able to stay in touch with it, stay connected with your empathy engine, and also learn from it, I guess, learn something from that empathy engine. The talking about, you know, your dad hiding out. So I've read the book. I was really fortunate. I was in a book club this time last year, and Jesse came to our book club. So we got to have some really straight up conversation with him about the book. And I'll share more of that once you're done. If you're curious, some of the stuff, if you have sort of some of your thoughts about it, you know, that's sort of like, what's up with this part, Clough? And there might have been a conversation that, you know, something that he mentioned about it. But what it got me thinking about was that, got me thinking about a couple of things. One, I think for the longest time, I had a message on my phone, on my voicemail from my dad that was just, I had two things. It was just a hilarious voicemail. I think he left his phone on and it was just like pocket talking. And I don't know, I actually have no clue to this day what it was, but there was something there. And I had that on my phone for the longest time. And I also had his first text, and it was absolute gobbledygook. Like, he had a phone where he was trying to text from that was, it was one of those flip phones where you had to hit the number 1 3 times just to get the letter C. So it was just, it was like a drunken text. I think I made out 2 or 3 words in there, but that was his first text. And both of those I lost when I replaced my phone. I forgot in just the transition and the reformatting, I lost them. So I lost the voicemail and I lost the text. That's the first thing that your thing makes me think about. Kind of sit there for a second as the empathy engine kicks in. So, and people that are just queuing in, my father died 2016. So the other thing that kicked in was that first year. So that I lost just prior to him dying. A similar feel of having that empathy engine just like lit up really quick was in the first year after he died, and I would get notifications from him on Facebook. Like, this is like, he would be popping up that there was like someone, I forget how it worked. He would sort of pop up on my timeline, his Facebook account. And it was a bit of a stunner, you know? And then there were people that were still reaching out, because my mom and I both had the credentials, and I could see that people would follow him and befriend him. So there was still activity there, right? And this was before socials really had serious conversations about what is your living will as it's related to your social media presence. Like Facebook didn't yet have that functionality in there, as in who should have access to this after you pass, like unless they have the original passcode to get there. So yeah, these are kind of lighting up those spaces for me, thinking about some of the artifacts of those relationships. And much like that broke down pan or pot that your mom has, you know, these things will have similar effects down the road when you're reminiscing about the food, right? You'll sort of thinking about that pot or pan and the bubbling oil in it. And it just comes right up through the oil, right? It just comes right up to the surface. And you start thinking about the relationship that came through that food. So it's good stuff.
I had to put my empathy engine glasses on.
I saw those. I saw them. The blue lenses. They're very nice.
Wouldn't it be cool though, if our empathy engine glasses are wearables, that once you start having a memory or a thought of a time where you could just click something and it would capture the essence of that emotion at that time, so you can relive it later if you really wanted to. There's so much here, man. What are we doing in education? Like, this is neuroscience. We should both be in some lab somewhere.
We should both be smarter than we are.
We should be in a lab figuring out how to do all this stuff with the brain. What? I feel like now I'm wasting away here doing what I'm doing.
I will say, though, the fact that we are both in public education allows us to dream this way. So thank you, public education, right? So we are in a space that allows us to have a Saturday where we can imagine these things. So
that's true, because I guess if we were neuroscientists in the lab, we would have no time off. We would just be constantly working on the empathy engine glasses.
Could be.
Yep, you said about your dad's Facebook account and stuff, this is something that kills me every time. My father, he died before the digital revolution, I guess, like, right?
So I know where you're going. I have no digital media
of my dad, and it kills me. I have no phone message from my dad. Mm-hmm. Oh man, that kills me. I can feel that, because look at what we're doing right now. We have, by the end of the summer, we will have four seasons of basically weekly talks that you and I have recorded on YouTube that our kids can stumble upon one day if they really want to. Mm-hmm. If they really want to, like, it's look at what we're accumulating, look at what we're creating for them to see. Like, I wish I could sit in front of this computer screen and see my dad talking to another person about something, anything. You know, to feel that again, to see my dad, to hear him, it's almost like the resurrection stone from Harry Potter, right? You just turn on YouTube and you're like, there's my dad. My dad's talking about something and I can see him and feel him and hear him.
Damn, that chokes me, man. I get it. I get it. I totally.
I got nothing. At least you have a Facebook site. I got nothing. And I don't even have a lot of pictures of my dad. They're all at my mom's house, and they're all old school. I have a graduation picture of me and my dad when I graduated with my undergrad, and it's in my son's room. But I don't really have pictures of my dad. My kids are growing up. They don't really have anything of their grandfather. Yeah. When we go to Ottawa, they see stuff. They see pictures and stuff of my dad, but there's no video. There's no audio. I have nothing. That sucks. But I will tell you, before YouTube, so I can, this is kind of, I'm going to call it MeTube. This is, and then after I'm done, I'd love to hear about From the Ashes, because, and Ramona's going to keep me honest here. She wrote a very moving book, From the Ashes. So Ramona's comment is going to bring me back. But, so I get into university. Okay. At that time, my father was a taxi driver. Mm-hmm. And my so I get into university, and I'm going to Carleton University. And right outside the most of the buildings, especially residence building, there was a taxi section. There was like 10 spots, mm-hmm. and cabs would pull in, and somebody would come out, and they take turns taking people wherever. And I remember one day saying to my dad, because I would park in the farthest lot, and as I was walking towards class, I would always walk past that area. I never saw my dad. And I remember saying to my dad one day, why are you never there? And he said, because you go to school there. And I was like, so? And he said, like, I wanna stay out of your way. I was like, okay. Now, I think my dad was probably thinking that I was embarrassed of him. But that wasn't the case. But anyway, I'm a young man. I'm not gonna go down that road with my dad. So MeTube. So there was a mall down the street. Billings Bridge Plaza, actually, and they also had like a taxi area, mm-hmm. and they had a McDonald's right beside the taxi area. So I would sometimes, before school or after school, head over to Billings and go through the drive-through, get something to eat, and then I'd always drive past because my dad gave me a car for graduation from high school, so I'd get to university. That's my dad, old, fairly old school, like I need to give my kid what he needs to get to school or whatever. So I would drive past that section. And if I saw my dad, I'd park the car and I'd come over and talk to him. That was my MeTube. That was like, and it sounds so simple. Like, you know where your dad works, so you go visit your dad. But there was something about that experience as I connect it to now, with the digital, that was like, I could sit in my car in this huge parking lot, the mall is huge, mm-hmm. and just watch my dad interact yeah. with other people. And sometimes my dad would be sitting in his car smoking, because, you know, smoking, I could see him, he'd smoke his cigarette and be reading the paper, waiting for a call or waiting for someone to come out and say, hey, I need to go somewhere. And sometimes I'd see my dad outside of his car, leaning against his car, talking to the other guys. So I do have that, because I knew where my dad was. There was something about Billings Bridge Plaza. He liked to park there. Like, he liked to wait for people there. And he used to go to Carleton. Then he stopped when I started going there. And I remember telling him, later on, near the end of my undergraduate, I was working residence security. And I remember saying to him, Dad, get your rear end over here. Like, we got drunk university students that need to go all over the place. And I was like, Dad, I'm the one calling cabs for these people. Get over here. There's money to be made. And he'd always say, thanks, but it's all good. I'll find another spot. I just... MeTube. And the funny thing, before I end, the funny thing about Billings Bridge Plaza was that many years ago when I was a kid, my father, who was a hairstylist, that was the trade he picked up as a young man in Lebanon. He learned how to be a hairstylist. And my dad was a bit of a player. He worked on women's hair, so he was surrounded by women all day. So my dad was a typical heterosexual male. He came to Canada, and at one point he owned his own hairstylist, his own salon at Billings Bridge Plaza. It's really neat because it came full circle that I remember as a young boy, as a little boy, my mom would take me, and I would sometimes go into the mall and go to the hair salon just to look at it. it was a barber shop at that point, but I just walked past and just stared at it. I'm sure people thought I was nuts, but I was like, hey, my dad used to own this place.
And then, you roll in like all high roller.
Yeah. My dad used to own this place. So
do
I remember,
you know who my dad is?
I remember going to Billingsbridge Plaza when I was a young boy to see my dad cutting hair. And then near the end, he'd be outside working. MeTube. So there you go. I'm done with that. I'd like to hear more about From the Ashes and your experience with Jesse.
So Jesse is when we were sort of, I think it was as I was setting it up, I thought, well, you know, it'd be kind of cool if the dude would come out and talk to us. So a little bit like how it worked out with Book Club for Men, it was just like a cold call. I emailed. Actually, what I did was I sent a message to him through Twitter, just saying, you know, doing this book club. It was colleagues from the high school that I was working at prior to the one that I'm at now. And as we got closer to the end of the year, so it's sort of this time last year, the fatigue was setting in, and you were starting to feel kind of like the lack of connection with your students, the lack of connection with your colleagues. So that was my sort of thinking, well, let's do this kind of like as a wellness community building thing. And I put it out to the staff. I said, who wants to join in with a book club? And so we picked that book, and I think it was just coming up to the first meeting. I thought, well, I'll put it to the crew and I'll say, you know, you cool with me reaching out, and we'll see if, you know, if he'll want to come and meet, talk to us about the book. Now, a couple things. At that point, some of us didn't even have the book yet. So we didn't have a fresh sense of the scope of the book. We knew, you know, like how you've done, you know, we did some research and we were sort of looking at online posts and some media there, but we didn't have a real clear idea of his story and how directly he was going to tell it to us. And there are the book is just, it's filled with what makes it really fascinating is it's filled with firsthand accounts that he himself has said, that some of it is memory, some of it is from police reports, some of it is from interviewing other people. Straight up, somewhere in the book, it was either in the prologue or in the epilogue, he says, basically, I'm putting this together from memories that aren't just mine, but the whole thing is told in first person. So you read and you're carried along on his journey of becoming. So when we invited him, after the invitation happened, like I said, I reached out on Twitter first, and then I got a message, a DM from Lucy, his wife, who is also his manager, I believe manager at the time, was the manager at the time. And she said, yeah, let's send me a Gmail. So she DM'd me her Gmail and send me the details, and Jesse's there. And you know, I kind of like, oh, okay. And I sent the details. I said, we're going to be doing a Google Meet. It's like, yeah, no problem. And I said, okay. And then afterwards I'm thinking, okay, maybe I need to think this through. Like, what professionally should I say in order to set this up properly? Like, am I supposed to ask other questions besides, hey, can you just come out and hang with us? And so I messaged back after that sort of initial shock wore off. I'm like, okay, this is cool. We're good. Mentioned it to the crew. Everybody in the group was, you know, down with it. I said, is there anything else I have to do? And she's like, no, he'll just show up. Send me the link. He'll show up. And he did. So we were sort of in the front end of just, okay, he's going to kind of be here any moment. Like, boop, boop, he pops up on the screen. It's like, oh, hey, how's it going? And then from there, it just really was. Everybody in the club had sort of like a very different thing that was holding them in the book, that was holding them in place. One of the people was really focused on the pieces of poetry that are in the book. Someone else was focused on, so actually me, I was really focused on the relationship with the grandparents, and especially looking at the beginning of the book, which is like an earlier, kind of like an earlier memory set up for the rest of the book of him when he's really young. I kept on kind of coming back to that connection with the grandparents. Somebody else was an equity consultant in our board, and they were connecting personal life experience to Jesse's life experience and talking about abandonment and addiction. So it was very, everybody had different things that we wanted to talk about. And he just arrived. He said, okay, let's do this. What do you want to know? And we worked through kind of all of our thinking with him. And he stayed with us for about an hour 15. And he said, you know, I could stay. He said, other circumstances, I could have stayed. He said, but I have another meeting just after this at 10 p.m. at night. And then he was gone. So it was a wonderful experience to be able to work through your thinking, work through your notes, to have the vulnerability that what was really fascinating about it is that we all had a moment. So this was this happened at the end of our reading cycle. So we had all finished the book when he had arrived. When we set it up though, it was before anybody had really started. Somewhere in the middle, we had a reckoning moment of holy crap. How do we talk to him about these things? And you're getting into the content, you know, I don't know where you are in the book, but there's no pulled sort of punches in it. It's a straight up feed for what his journey was about. And we all had a collective sort of moment of how do we assure dignity in our discussion? And he completely disarmed that in the beginning. He says, look, ask any question you want, any question you want. He goes, I left everything that I needed to on the page. Ask away. And from that point on, it just really did become we found out a bunch of stuff. There's stuff that we found, again, I'll tell you off air or another time, but there's cool stuff that he spoke about that, you know, some of the stuff he's like, oh, I'm not sure if I should be sort of talking about this, but I'll share a little bit. So you got even more, a little bit of an insider feel for some of the stuff he was talking about. So it was very cool. It was very cool. And he was very cool and calm. And he very much made his book, kind of strange to say, he made sure his book and his lived experience was available to us to learn a little bit from. So a little bit more.
I'm really impressed with what I've seen of him. In the ways that he speaks about his experience. I'm really digging, it's like a Clough move. And the reason I say that is because in the Book Club for Men, which you have been part of since the beginning, which I think is awesome, and I really appreciate that, you do a really good job of curating music and articles and bits and pieces that jive well with the books that we read in the club. And I've always appreciated the fact that you had the foresight and I guess the energy to do that. Because usually in the book club for men, like, I'm kind of like, okay, guys, this is when we're meeting, this is how long we're meeting for. And then out of nowhere, you're like, hey, guys, they're talking about this music in the book. Check it out. Go to this site. I've got it all curated. And the guys love it. I pulled a Clough. And as I'm reading the book, I'm like, I want to know more now. I want when Jesse talks about certain things in the book, I want to know more about that now. I want to add to this experience. And so, you know, I'm really enjoying the short chapters. And I saw in an interview that Jesse said that was done purposely. so to keep the reader wanting more. Because he's like, if I write, you know, a 50-page chapter, because that's not going to work for some people, but if I write a 10-page chapters, people read it and they're like, oh, that wasn't bad, I'm going to read another one. And they just keep reading. So, like, to hear the author talk about his process, his strategy, the purpose, like, these things are gold to me. And and I'm just really impressed with how he presents himself in, and it's so cool because I've seen him do like formal lecture type and then informal book chat type. And it's really cool just to hear this person talk about his experience and the things behind it. I'm fascinated. Aside from the fact that it's taking me down a road that maybe I don't necessarily want to deal with in my personal life, it's still, it's all good stuff, right? I think it's good. It's making me a better person. So thanks for sharing that. I, you know, maybe one day there are enough guys in the book club for men that have read From the Ashes that maybe one day we can put something together where we can talk to Jesse. Because many of us, a lot of the guys have said that they've read the book. So that's cool. I just find it fascinating. I find it fascinating that somebody that his story's raw. I mean, lots of people have lived lives that if they put in a text format, other people would step up and read it and learn from it and appreciate it, which kind of moves me to a colleague in my school board, Jamie Rodrigue. Jamie's a vice principal, but he was a high school teacher for like some 20 odd years. Now I think is his third year in administration. He's a VP, high school VP. And the other day he started up his own YouTube channel. And he said, he's come outright and said in his videos, I've wanted to be a YouTuber for a long time. He's like, I'm a middle-aged man who wants to create content. He wants to be creative. But he also, for the longest time, has wanted to be a YouTuber. And he's finally made the decision to do it 110%. He's made three videos so far. Remember last summer I was doing the two teachers thing? Where we'd record some content, I would record some content, we'd exchange our content, and then we'd make a video out of it?
Yeah.
That's Jamie. He was part of that project.
And, cool.
Yeah, and now he's dedicated himself. And so how does this relate to what I'm talking about with Jesse Thistle? Jamie has not lived the same life as Jesse Thistle, but Jamie is wanting to be open about living his life. And yes. He wants to do it using YouTube as the tool to create and to share content. And there's something attractive and there's something empowering about that. And I think it's probably, for me, it's probably being middle-aged and realizing certain things about who I am. Like, I'm learning a lot more about who I am today than I did 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But I think I'm in the right space to do it. So I'm learning about myself and I'm enjoying myself. Like us and our hashtag Geezer Gamers, Geezer Gaming. Like, we're both middle-aged dudes who have realized that we can have some fun on the internet playing some cool games that make us happy and make us like just have some fun. Mm-hmm. And I wish that I could have been more like this 10 years ago. Even though I wished that, though, it wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have worked. And I'm starting to see something. I don't know what to call it, a trend, a pattern, the way life is. I look at the younger teachers I work with, and I laugh when they ask me a question, I give them advice, I laugh. And they're like, what is your problem? I'm like, I don't know if any of this is going into your head. Like, I don't know if you can actually absorb what I just said to you. Because when I heard this 10 or 15 years ago, I didn't absorb any of it. Now, I'm not saying everybody's like me, but there's something about it that they may not resonate, it may not sink in until they get to where I am today
That's true.
And then realize, oh my God, that was some golden stuff. Like when I look back at some of the veterans that I worked with over the years and the advice they gave me or helping me navigate certain situations, I have this huge appreciation for what they told me, but I have that appreciation today. I didn't have it 10 years ago. And now as a middle-aged educator, thinking about moving into formal leadership, I'm thinking about and remembering and dealing with some of the things that were told to me by my administrators 5, 10, 12 years ago, and now only understanding what that means. Now only understanding kind of like the weight on my shoulders as an educator who gets to work with all kinds of different people. This kind of hit me hard recently when one of the mentees I worked with sent me an email and said, Roland, I need to talk to you about something. And I got a vibe that I got a vibe. I'm like, yeah, what is it? Like, I'm putting everything down. What do you need to talk about? Because I just felt like it was going to be something of substance. And he told me he's doing something and he's reading a book with his kids, but he fast-forwarded a little bit and read the book ahead and realized that some of the content of the book he wasn't comfortable with. And he said to me, what do I do? It's a typical rookie teacher question. What do? Do I abandon the book? If I abandon the book, does that mean I'm not a good teacher because I didn't pre-read the book? I should have pre-read the book. Like, he's going through all this stuff that you go through when you're new and you're not really feeling as confident as you'd like to be. And my response to him was such a compassionate, humanistic response that he was shocked by it, which then worried me because I was like, do I not present myself as your mentor? Do I not present as a compassionate person who is interested in your positive mental health and your student mental health? Like, it was, I said some things to him that I felt I was channeling through all the administrators that have taught me what leadership is. Not like, oh, you look at policy A3502 and you answer. No, this is how you lead people. This is what you do when you are with the people. And I had this moment. I channeled them with a twist of who I am. And his response was, thank you so much for that wisdom, which I'm like, that's not mine, dude. That's come from everything I've, like, that's, it's many things, many places coming out right now to you. And he said he wasn't expecting my response. But my response was basically, hey, you have a gut feeling and you're not feeling good. And if you're not feeling good, your kids aren't going to feel good. And you're here for the kids. So what do you need to do to ensure that they're okay? You need to ensure that you're okay. So you need to do what you need to do. And I can't tell you what to do, but I feel like I know what direction you're going to go in. It was just interesting the way it came out. I think he was expecting something else from me. He wasn't expecting a humanistic response. He wasn't expecting that. He was expecting maybe for me to refer to curriculum documents or policy. And I was like, no. No policy, no documents. You're not feeling good. That tells me that there's something wrong. What's wrong? And you don't have to tell me, but what's wrong? And then fix it. Because you're telling me you're not good. And you're worried about your students. That's perfect. Listen to that and go with it. Hmm. And then there's some back and forth and I'm blown away by his response. He was blown away by my response. And I'm like, dude, we're just two teachers hashing things out. That's what I'm here for. I'm here to listen to you. And I'm here to, I guess, answer questions if that's what you want, or to just listen if that's what you want. What do you want? Right? I felt it. And he said he gets it. Now, he is a little bit older. He's not a 24-year-old new teacher. He's like a 30-something, early 40s new teacher. So I think he's creeping up on that middle age thing that gets people thinking differently and feeling differently. But I laugh. Every time a newer teacher asks me a question, I just laugh. Because I'm like, well, here's my response to you. Call me in 20 years if it makes sense to you then. Because it might not make sense to you now. And the other big thing I'm into is, do you really want to ask me that? or are you just being polite? Because I don't have, I'm done. I don't have any more time to hang with you if you don't really want to talk with me.
Yeah, it's true.
I'm done. I want to hang out with people like you, Clough, and Ramona and Sherry, people who like want to engage in this stuff and mm-hmm. who want to move forward. I don't have time. I don't want to give the time anymore. So some really cool stuff. And the best part is that one day my kids might listen to this mm-hmm. and they might get a feel for who their dad was outside of the jerk telling them to pick up their plates and signing them up for power skating when they don't want to do that and all that stuff, you know? That's what I wanted to say there.
That was very well said.
Have you been drawing today?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. is that Maria?
Yeah. Or it's the
grandma?
It's the grandma. It's the every Maria.
Every, you know who's that lady looks like? Or I'm don't. Assuming it's a lady.
Could be.
It reminds me of the lady that cleans our house. Oh, she's Romanian and she's got to look like that. She's an awesome lady, but she looks like that. And her hair's like that too.
That's the look. I've gotten that look before. I've been on the receiving end of that look. So it's all good. And I've lived to tell the tale.
Well, look at this. Ramona loves the drawing.
we're going to be opening up we're going to call it Decoded Jabs, and it's going to be our tattoo shop.
We're starting a tattoo shop.
Yeah, now? that's the next thing. Decoded Jabs. And Ramona, for the, you know, of a very reasonable price, you could get this right across your back if you want. we'll offer some discounts on the front end because Roland and I will have to develop this. Like everything, we'll just develop the fluency. We're going to call it a fluency. We're going to get better at it. So someone says, you know, that tattoo doesn't look like the drawing. It's like, well, I'm a work in progress. You're just going to use assessment for at this point. It's not or assessment as. It's not an assessment of yet. So yeah, there you go. It'll be perfect, right?
We have basically become like that company called Alphabet. We've got so many things going on.
Kombucha. Or Amazon. Yeah.
Or Amazon.
Yeah. Let's aim higher. Let's be the Amazon of the what are they called? Non-fungible token kind of stuff. So we gotta create all these sort of like real things that only exist in digital spaces and see if we can get people to pay for them.
The shack out back is becoming like the factory out back.
Yeah, shack out back.
We got Empathy Engines, Geezer yep. Gaming, the Kombucha.
We got the Jabs Tattoo Shop.
What else do we are those the four main things?
Eyeballs.
Oh yeah, the eyeballs. Yeah. Yep. I still that tweet. I'm still laughing.
What was
that.
Our publishing? I don't think we ever nail down our publishing arm of.
I don't know. Was it just Decoded Publishing? We've got to come up with a better name than that.
I think it was maybe SOB Publishing.
SOB Publishing, yeah. And
But it's Shack Out Back.
Right.
Of course.
Right,
it's of Shack course. Out Back. But we just say SOB Publishing. And, you know, that book that still is the working title.
Sucka. That's what, our publishing company should be called Hey Sucka.
Thanks for buying the book.
When you could have read it all for free on my feed.
Did you even check my feed? So, yeah, SOB Publishing. There we go. I think that's all the products. That's got to be all the products. We got a lot on the go.
I can't believe we recruited or we ended up with a principal, an elementary school principal as our kombucha.
The brewmaster.
The brewmaster. That's pretty dope.
That's real. That's what makes imagining real. So,
you know, she gifted me with kombucha once, right?
I think you mentioned. How did that treat you?
It was good. Homemade kombucha. One day at work, last year, the year before, She came to visit my vice principal, who's in the house today. Sherry, thanks for checking us out. And she left me a bottle of kombucha.
Nice.
I guess she wanted me to taste the stuff before we truly hired her to be the brewmaster. But this tattoo thing's killing me. Who's going to do the tattoos? You're the artist person. And across Ramona's back, like, we're going to ruin her life like that?
I get the concepts right, but I have shaky hands. Actually, that might be even better than jabs. We call it shaky hands. Shaky hands tattoos.
Here's the best thing.
Deep, deep discount pricing at Shaky Hands Tattoos.
The picture you drew, it would be epic if you drew another one like it with the same outline, but with your hands shaking the whole time. I would love to see what that would look like. Oh, look, Ramona's back. She's not interested.
Maybe just on a t-shirt.
Maybe just on a t-shirt. Okay.
We can do that too. We can do that too. Play safe.
Talk me through your process.
Talk me through your process, t-shirts.
Okay.
We good?
I think we're good. Thanks for the chat today.
You're very welcome, sir. Have a fantastic Saturday.
Yeah, you too. Peace.
Peace.